If it were just about calories, every person listening who's ever been weight loss resistant wouldn't have been weight loss resistant. There's a time to fast, there's a time not to fast, because if it were just that easy, all of us could drop weight.
Cynthia Thurlow,
a TEDx speaker and fasting expert,
the best-selling author of Intermittent Fasting Transformation,
and the creator of the Everyday Wellness podcast.
Fasting in and of itself can help with blood pressure management, lipid management, the health of our gut microbiome, Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's really is a very of diabetes of the brain. Mitophagy, autophagy, this can be life shifting. I actually came to fasting and realized, like, I feel so mentally clear. Now I recognize what true intrinsic hunger feels like. I have less bloating. My bowel movements are more regular. I'm sleeping better. Fasting has a season and a reason. I did not intermittent fast for probably 4 to 5 months after that hospitalization. When someone says to me, I do OMAD and they're a woman, or they have a 20-hour fast with a 4-hour feeding window, the first thing I ask them is, how much protein are you eating every day? Do not white knuckle fasting if it's not working for you. It might be there's a certain time in your life, or maybe it's where you are in your cycle, or there's too much stress. Now, people will argue till the cows come home, stevia doesn't impact my blood glucose. Well, I bet you it impacts your insulin. They're now adding sugar to salt so that people want more of it. We want a clean fast. We don't want to fudge it.
Let's talk about what breaks a fast. So you mentioned coffee. Why does that break a fast? Cynthia, welcome.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to connect with you.
I've spent over 100 hours researching fasting, and there is so much different information out there. And that's why I'm so excited to speak to you, Cynthia, a fasting expert with over 10 years of experience. And you wrote the book about fasting and how to get results in just 45 days. And there's different types of fasting. There's prolonged fasting, time-restricted eating, there's autophagy fasting, intermittent fasting, and all of those different types of fast are going to get you different results. So before we get into the results and the different types of fasting, it's very important to understand the mechanism of fasting, what it does in the body. So my first question, Cynthia, what is the biggest thing that fasting does in the body?
Oh gosh, there's so many. I think on a very basic level, it's helping people understand that we have this reduction in inflammation. We lead hedonistic lifestyles. We largely eat ultra-processed food. A lot of the things that we do, we don't sleep enough. We don't manage our stress. And so the consequence of that is that we can be dealing with chronic inflammation. It can show up as weight loss resistance. It can show up as pain or inflammation. And so on a very basic level, when we're eating less frequently, we are helping to reduce the burden on our bodies and can help help with reducing inflammation. I also think about the neurocognitive benefits, you know, things like lowering our risk for developing Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. And for anyone that's listening, Alzheimer's really is a variation of diabetes of the brain. And so helping people understand how critically important it is to make sure that we have healthy and optimized glucose and insulin levels in the body. I think many people may not even be aware of something called autophagy, this waste and recycling process that goes on in our bodies. And it goes on in largely in an unfed state. So when we are eating, we are in a state where we are storing calories in many instances. When we are not eating, we are in a state where we are potentially, you know, going in and using stored energy for fuel. Now, people will argue when autophagy really starts to upregulate itself. And so I remind people that even if you fast for 16 hours, you're still conferring benefits. But we know typically the longer the fast, the more autophagy, and helping people understand that those disease disordered cells, organelles that could have the potential to go on and create disease, our body does a beautiful job of packaging them up and getting rid of them. And after the age of 40, most of us have slowed autophagy, which is why we deal with chronic disease states. I also think about improved biophysical markers. So fasting in and of itself can help with blood pressure management. It can help with lipid management. It can help with the health of our gut microbiome, which I know is a really hot topic for many of us right now. And then just on a very basic level, the concept of mental clarity, understanding that when we are eating less frequently, we are able to actually break down stored fatty acids. We have the potential to produce ketones. One in particular called beta-hydroxybutyrate diffuses across the blood-brain barrier. So I think many people are surprised that when they start fasting and they've been doing it long enough, they're like, wow, I really feel great. Like when I do interviews like this, I like to do them fasted because I have so much more mental clarity. It's not that I normally fall asleep after eating, but for me, it's that mental sharpness and mental aptitude, which is really, really important. But those are some of the basic things that I think about with a traditional, you know, shortened time frame in which you are not eating. So helping people understand that you will not starve, that your body really does know, and all of us, even thin people, have enough stored energy that their body can tap into. But in our traditional modern day lifestyles, we've been conditioned to overeat, to overconsume, to eat too frequently. And we've, in a sense, we have mucked up our body's ability to use different types of fuel substrates or different types of fuels to fuel our body. So fasting will help us get back to that alignment of being able to use stored energy, both carbohydrates and fats, as fuel sources. And for a lot of individuals, this can be life shifting, especially individuals that are primarily carbohydrate burners. They're people that get hangry if they're not eating every 2 to 3 hours, or they have energy slumps, as some examples, or they become weight loss resistant, is really speaking to the fact that we are not properly fueling our bodies.
I wanted to zoom in terms of the hormonal changes that happen. And the first one is insulin. How fasting affects insulin? How does that happen?
Yeah. So insulin is this hormone that tends to get a bad rap, largely because there are so many of us that are insulin resistant or metabolically unhealthy. Insulin is a hormone that will be impacted by what we choose to eat. So obviously, fat is going to have the most negligible impact on blood sugar, as well as insulin secretion, then protein, and then carbohydrates, probably not surprisingly. So helping people understand that insulin, one of many byproducts of insulin is that insulin helps with a lock and key mechanism. Depending on what we eat, our body is constantly looking for homeostasis. It is constantly looking to maintain an appropriate range of blood glucose, so blood sugar. And, you know, after we eat, our body is looking to move blood glucose into the cell. So moving it intracellularly, and insulin, one of insulin's roles is to help our bodies do this. But what can happen over time is that if our body is constantly flooded with very high blood sugar levels, and I would represent that as a blood sugar level of 140 is damaging the endothelium. It is damaging the lining of our blood vessels, our retinal vessels, our kidney vessels. Becomes problematic. So that very narrow index of where we want to see our blood glucose levels, when it over time, if we are constantly overeating carbohydrates, eating ultra processed foods, there's a lot of really significant research on ultra processed foods as an example. But over time, we can wear out those insulin receptors. And so it makes it harder and harder for our body to regulate moving blood glucose or moving glucose into cells, moving it intracellularly. And then it's almost like someone's knocking on a door and insulin's, you know, that cannot hear, or, you know, the knock can't move the glucose into the cell. And over time, we start developing insulin resistance, ultimately hyperinsulinemia, which is hugely problematic and is really at the basis of most, if not all, chronic disease states. So when I'm thinking about insulin and helping people understand, it's important for us to eat. It's important for us to be conscientious about what we're eating. But it's also helping people understand that when our insulin levels are high, we are not able to access stored fat. It's when our insulin levels are low, which is like in between meals, that's what should happen. While we're sleeping, that is what should happen. Or in a fasted state, this is when our body has the ability to tap into fat stores to use as energy. And that's an important distinction. So as an example, I routinely draw fasting insulin levels on my patients. And I encourage anyone who's watching this to ask for your physician, nurse practitioner, physician's assistant to get a fasting insulin check several times a year. I probably check mine 3 or 4 times a year. You want that range, at least here in the United States, between 2 to 5 milligrams per deciliter. I cannot tell you how many women I've worked with who have fasting insulin levels that are 20, 25, 30, and they can't figure out why they can't lose weight because their blood glucose may look fine. Their A1C, which is a marker of 90 days of blood glucose control, looks okay. But this is oftentimes very much the first sign of insulin resistance, is that fasting insulin is high. And if your fasting insulin is high, you are not going to be able to lose weight. And there's many reasons why this can happen. But that's the big takeaway about insulin that I think is so important for your listeners to understand.
So it's not that insulin is bad. elevated insulin is bad all the time. And that's what fasting does, along with having a good diet. It lowers your insulin. So you have these periods of not eating so that you can, your insulin can come down, your glucose can come down. Very interestingly, you did mention the testing your fasting insulin. And I know that you did an interview with Dr. Ken Berry. So he was saying that you should test your fasting insulin levels way before testing glucose. And that is a precursor towards knowing if you're pre-diabetic. That is so important.
It is very important. And sometimes if you look at the research, it's suggesting that that fasting insulin can start to dysregulate 5 to 10 years prior to your glucose being abnormal. So to give you an example, a fasting glucose in the 90s is not benign. Like, let's be very clear. I think it was Robert Lustig who taught me that a fasting glucose in the 90 to 99 range, you have a 30% likelihood of developing diabetes. This is fast. This is not after eating a meal, but helping people understand that we have this very narrow range. And unfortunately, and I say this with great respect and reverence, you know, as a licensed healthcare provider, how many of us have watched our patients become diabetic before our eyes and we're not looking for the elephant in the room? So I would 100% agree. I always say fasting insulin is one of the first labs I do with my patients and clients. And for everyone that's listening, it's usually very inexpensive. Here in the United States, you can go to Own Your Labs or Direct Labs. I have no affiliation with either. You can easily and inexpensively get that number. And if it's not within that 2 to 5 milligrams per deciliter, there are things you can do to change that. That's the important message, is it's not, if it's high, there's nothing you can do. You absolutely can. Lifestyle is medicine. And certainly if you are working with someone that draws that already, kudos to you. I think sometimes the average is that medical research takes about 20 years to trickle down into clinical practice. But if your physician or NP or PA is not ordering that test, ask for it. If they're not willing to order it, sometimes I hear my doctor doesn't know how to interpret it. That's a cop out. I would still get that lab done very inexpensively. It's probably like the cost of 2 coffees, 2 fancy foofy coffees in a coffee house. You can definitely afford it. Get it checked, find out what your number is, and then adjust your lifestyle accordingly.
So fasting insulin is very important to test. Oh, another thing I want to ask about, which is fasting, how it affects the hormone. So it affects your ghrelin, which is your hunger hormone. So it's going to regulate that. It affects your cortisol. It's going to bring that down so you feel more calmer and happier. But I'm very interested in leptin. That is your fullness hormone. Can you talk more about how fasting, different types of fasting, can affect your leptin?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for so many of us, we have gotten so conditioned from what fueling our body feels like. What does true intrinsic hunger feel like? What makes our bodies feel good? And so the hormone leptin, and you can become leptin resistant, just like you can be insulin resistant. And this is very important for people to understand, because it's not as if leptin and insulin resistance go hand in hand. You can be one without the other. So let me be very clear, because I oftentimes will hear healthcare professionals saying, oh, they go together. Sometimes they do, and sometimes they do not. I've had people with normal insulin levels that have high leptin levels. So let's back up and talk about this hormone. It's a hormone that is drawing communication between our stomach and the brain. This can become dysregulated. It can become dysregulated because we've lost our ability to determine when we're hungry. It can be impacted by meal frequency, choices of foods. I'm going to keep hammering on the ultra processed food piece, but we know based on research, the average person here in the United States, 70% of their diet is ultra processed foods. We know if you're eating that much ultra processed foods, you are consuming way more calories. You may not even be aware of it. So you're consuming highly inflammatory foods that very likely are food-like substances, let's be clear. And by this, I mean, I'm not talking about you have a 3-ingredient packaged food. I'm talking about the stuff that has 90 ingredients, most of which you don't know what it is. It makes you hyperphagic, meaning that it, you know, whether it's the protein bar that's kind of disguised as a candy bar, whether or not it's the crackers, the cookies, the Doritos, the Cheetos, it dysregulates the communication between our stomach and our brain. And that's designed, there's a bliss point. These processed food companies design foods to be as blissful and addictive as possible. And so understanding that a lot of these foods will trick our bodies into thinking we are not full when in fact we are. And so leptin is that hormone. When it's functioning optimally, you will have these stretch receptors in your stomach. The communication to your brain says you are full, let's stop eating. And people that have leptin resistance, they just keep eating and eating and eating. And it is not that they lack willpower. It is not that they aren't trying hard enough. It is that their brain has been hijacked by these food-like substances that are dysregulating this communication pattern. There are other reasons why this can happen. Even things like mold and mycotoxins can inflame the brain. But from a very basic level, I think most of us know when we don't have leptin properly regulated because our appetite just doesn't get shut off. I will give an example. I speak very openly that I am gluten, grains, and dairy free. I'm very happy in this space, but I can tell you that if someone were to give me a gluten-free cookie or a gluten-free pie or a gluten-free cupcake, my dysregulation in my brain just starts to get scattered. And we can make the argument that it's the flour that's doing that because flour can be very addictive or the sugar that's doing it. But for me and an otherwise very healthy person that eats a nutrient-dense diet, even I can get some dysregulation, whether it's the dopamine hits that are going on in the brain combined with the sugar and the flour, that can impact my leptin signaling and tell me, oh, you can have another piece of pie. You can have another 5 cookies. You can have more cake. And so this happens even in healthy people, but traditional leptin's job, and there's many functions of leptin, but the big kind of hierarchy prevailing macro view is that this is our hormone that helps us understand when we are full. And when we are eating less frequently, we're going to get to a point where we recognize what is true intrinsic hunger. I know what that feels like. I know how my stomach feels. I get that stomach growl. It's not that I'm dehydrated. So it can reinforce that communication pattern. You know, the gut-brain axis is a real axis, helping us understand to properly regulate our nutritional patterns. And I find for a lot of people that that in and of itself is one of those benefits of intermittent fasting that we probably don't talk enough about. You know, for many people, they're so accustomed to eating too frequently, too often, the wrong types of macros, and they don't realize that that meal frequency and the improperly balanced macros in and of itself can really do significant and profound, I don't want to use the word damage, it sounds very pejorative, but can dysregulate this delicate communication pattern in a way that reinforces these maladaptive behaviors.
So as Cynthia mentioned, how often we eat is just as important as what we are eating. But the thing is, our bodies are very unique in terms of how they respond to different foods, even if you're following a keto or a carnivore lifestyle. And that's why it can be very important to test how certain foods affect your body in real time. And that's exactly what NutriSense offers. They offer a program which includes a continuous glucose monitor, which is just a small device that you put on the back of your arm. So basically, after having a meal or a drink, all you do is open the NutriSense app, tap, and you will see in real time what's happening to your glucose levels. And the great thing about NutriSense is that you don't have to do it on your own. They will match you with a nutritionist that will help you understand the data. They will go through the CGM data and come up with a personalized plan just for you. And this is really important so that you'll understand what foods affect you, how often to eat, and what to eat. And this can help you create a healthier lifestyle in the long term. And I have used the NutriSense app. And as you know, I follow a carnivore diet. So it wasn't so much what I was eating, it was what I was drinking. Using the NutriSense app, I found that having my mid-morning coffee spiked my glucose. So what I did was I took out the coffee and I noticed I felt calmer. I felt less anxious during the day and I was sleeping better. And the great thing about it now is that I can understand the coffee wasn't great, but I'm more interested to understand what carnivore foods are affecting me in the longer term. So what I want to do is test different carnivore foods over the next 6 months using the NutriSense app so I can see exactly what foods are affecting me, plus the drinks, and I can also make better options for myself to have a healthier lifestyle in the future. So if you'd like to try NutriSense, just go to NutriSense.io and use the code 5MinuteBody to get $50 off. And they'll also give you 1 month free nutrition support. Thank you so much to NutriSense for sponsoring this video. But circling back to the time between meals, it's very important. You mentioned this fancy word in your other videos, which is the migrating motor complex. I was like, oh, that sounds fancy. Can you explain what that means and why it's important to have that break for your gut in between meals?
Yeah. So the migrating motor complex, or the MMC, which is, again, one of these kind of nerdy factoids, and it's real science, helping people understand it's almost functioning as a janitor in the digestive system. So, you know, when we allow 4 to 5 hours in between meals, this migrating motor complex, it's just looking to push food forward. It's also helping to clear up pathogens or things that don't belong in the gut microbiome. But when we're eating with great frequency, it mucks up this mechanism. So probably most of your listeners are familiar with something called SIBO, so small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And if you talk about SIBO and you look at the research, in many instances, that mechanism is disrupted. So this gut motility mechanism is not working properly. So not only are they at greater risk for developing overgrowth of non-beneficial bacteria or fungi, because there's even SIFO now, small intestinal fungal overgrowth, which sounds scary, but helping people understand that when we are in an unfed state, it's not just that we have less bloating and maybe we have better digestion, it's that our body gets to optimize this very delicate process of moving food forward, clearing out pathogens, things that do not belong, and that when we're eating all the time, it doesn't allow our body to be properly regulated. And so I think it's important to help people understand that when we are not optimizing our digestion, this is when we deal with constipation, this is when we deal with diarrhea or lots of gas or bloating. How many women tell me they are chronically habitually bloated, and that can come from a lot of different things. So the migrating motor complex is this little nerdy mechanism that goes on in the body. It's very important. It's important for us to understand that distance between our meals allows our body to get ready. It's almost like it has to reset itself to be able to consume food again, and helping people understand this is why I talk about not eating every 2 to 3 hours, because you're not allowing your body to set up this mechanism to move food forward and address these potential pathogens that you could have been exposed to or even ingested. I always think about, you know, the fact that regular lettuce has plenty of little parasites on it. And that's why we wash our vegetables before we eat them. But in someone who has a healthy gut microbiome or a healthy stomach acid, which is, you know, in the stomach, they should be able to, as a first line of defense, be able to kill off that parasite. But for a lot of people that don't have a healthy digestive system, it makes them more susceptible to picking up opportunistic infections.
So you mentioned the gut microbiome. Can you explain for people watching, what is the gut microbiome and what is the effect that fasting has in it for the health of the gut microbiome?
Yeah, the gut microbiome is having a moment. I would say the amount of experts I've interviewed on the podcast in the last couple months has really exploded. So we're talking about this very delicate ecosystem in our colon, so the large intestine. So when we eat, it goes into our esophagus, into our stomach, goes into the small intestine, then ultimately the large intestine. And different parts of the colon have an anaerobic environment, which means there's oxygen, or there's an aerobic environment where there's oxygen, anaerobic environment where there lacks oxygen. And that's done specifically because of different types of keystones bacteria. So as an example, Akkermansia is a keystone bacteria, very important for many things in the body, including the production of mucus. It's involved in GLP-1. So for anyone's heard of semaglutide and Wegovy, we make our own endogenous GLP-1 in the body. And it's intricately involved in that, as well as creating things like short-chain fatty acids, like butyrate, things probably your listeners are familiar with. So when I think about the gut microbiome, it is impacted by so many things: our stress levels, our sleep quality. Is our circadian rhythm disrupted? Like, are we doing, do we have jet lag? Are we traveling? Like, you're in another continent. If I were to travel to where you are right now, you better believe my gut microbiome is going to change in response to changes in my circadian biology. It's also impacted by what we eat. It is also impacted by how frequently we eat. And so when I think about a lot of the benefits of fasting, it's the benefits that are conferred to our digestive system, but also understanding that, you know, wherever we are in terms of our gut microbiome, and you can do testing to look at this. So, you know, this is not contrived. We actually look at stool samples to be able to tell, like, do we have plenty of beneficial bacteria, or do we have a lot of opportunistic bacteria that make us more susceptible to certain types of infections or imbalances in the microbiome. But we know that the food that we consume can feed the bacteria, but there are prebiotics, like things like asparagus and onions. There are postbiotics, you know, things that are designed to be able to help the health of the gut microbiome. And then we have probiotics. So organisms like fermented foods. A lot of people talk about supplements as they pertain to this, but for the purposes of our conversation, I'll focus solely on food. But understanding all of these foods provide information to the terrain of that gut microbiome. And I know that depending on someone's traditional philosophy towards food, there'll be various opinions on this. I know that for myself, I say this clinically myself and then professionally, when I was hospitalized 5 years ago for 13 days, my entire gut microbiome just got profoundly disrupted because of how sick I was and 6 weeks of antibiotics and antifungals and a hospitalization and a surgery and a whole bunch of other things. And it has probably taken me 5 years to get back to a baseline of where I was before. So, you know, depending on where you are, if you were to get stool testing done and you and your practitioner look at your stool and decide that there are things you need to work on, it's always on this trajectory of, you know, you can be on antibiotics and yes, that's going to disrupt things to a point, but there are things that you can do to counteract the effects of antibiotics, antifungals, chronic stress, sleep deprivation. But I think I would be remiss if I didn't talk about the fact that our lifestyle plays such a huge role in the health of our bodies. And anyone that thinks otherwise is really foolish. I would say the other thing is when women go through menopause and men go through andropause, there are changes to the terrain of the microbiome. The entire digestive tract is a byproduct of changes in estradiol, which is the predominant form of estrogen, as well as other changes that go on. I'm more familiarized with women because that's who I work with. But helping people understand there's always something you can do. And I think for everyone that's listening, whether it's meal frequency, whether it is the foods we choose to eat, whether it is how we manage our stress. And for many of us, our stress shows up in our digestive system, whether it's diarrhea, constipation, bloating, gas, et cetera, things that we just take as normal don't have to be our normal. So getting back to your original question, I think the gut microbiome is really important. I think over the last 5 to 10 years, we've learned a lot. There's not enough research. It's ongoing. And certainly when I talk to the experts, the things that I think make the biggest difference in the health of our gut microbiome, the intermittent fasting or meal frequency, the quality of the foods we eat, how we manage our stress, how much we sleep. And yes, you do get a change in the terrain in your gut microbiome when you travel. So I'm getting ready to take a trip with my family in a couple weeks. And I know that jet lag is definitely going to play a role in what's going on in my gut microbiome, but I know what I need to be doing to help counteract that.
So it's interesting, the fasting, it has so many health benefits. I wanted to touch on the one last thing before we go into these fasting schedules, which I think people are just dying to hear. So calories in, calories out. I see this so much that people just want to fast, but they're just under eating calories. So I really wanted to ask you, for weight loss or even healing inflammation, does calories in, calories out matter?
This is such an important question because I'm not suggesting the calories don't matter. Because if you were to say to me, Cynthia, I allow myself 1,500 calories a day and 1,300 of which are going to come from a carton of ice cream, is very different than having a nutrient-dense diet. Let's say you have steak and maybe a vegetable and you have two or three meals during the course of your day. That information that your body takes in from whole nutrient-dense foods is very different than when you take in a highly processed, yet delicious, high in sugar, high in fat, dairy, delicacy. I'll just say a delicacy because in my house, ice cream is king. My sons and my husband, it's like their kryptonite. But when people take the concept of calories, which is a unit of measurement, and they try to reduce it and whittle it down, like a lot of the bro science guys, no offense guys, but that's typically where I see it. They'll just say, you know, it's a 25-year-old who's super fit and ripped. And he's like, oh, the way you lose weight is you just restrict your calories. There's so much more to it. It takes out the impact of hormones and how hormones are regulated. I would be the first person to say, any woman who's listening knows that there are times in your menstrual cycle when it is a whole lot easier to lose weight than others. If you're a woman in perimenopause or menopause, all of you know that it is far more sophisticated than just calories in, calories out. So I think that calories matter. That's always the message I send, but it is far more important what we're eating and when we're eating that'll help regulate whether or not we're able to lose weight. As an example, if you look at the research, if you're eating within 2 hours of bedtime, that's not going to just disrupt your sleep regulation because you'll suppress, melatonin and increase cortisol, but it also can lead to, your heart rate gets elevated, your body temperature is probably elevated while your body's trying to process this bolus of food before bed, as opposed to knowing that we are more insulin sensitive earlier in the day. And my first meal of the day is usually my biggest. I also know I'm more insulin sensitive. I probably have exercised before I ate my meal, my first meal of the day. And for me, I do best eating, I stop eating by 5 o'clock at night. Now, that's not what happens when I do things socially, but I live in a house of teenagers and a very flexible husband. And as the teenagers are in and out, it allows me to have a little bit more flexibility. It was the blessing of the pandemic that I realized I don't like eating dinner at 7 or 8 o'clock at night. I just don't feel good. So for everyone that's watching, there is more to it than calories. Calories are a unit of measurement. And if it were just about calories, every person listening who's ever been weight loss resistant wouldn't have been weight loss resistant. Because if it were just that easy, all of us could drop weight. There is so much more to it. And it's not just the hormonal imbalances. It's also toxins we're exposed to, microplastics. This is not woo-woo. There's actual science and research being done in these areas, whether it's personal care products, what we're exposed to our environment or our food. Microplastics in and of itself is a huge problem, which can dysregulate not only estrogen, but can also impact testosterone quite significantly. The number one and two reasons why we're dealing with low testosterone in men, number one is insulin resistance. Number two is toxins. And this is, again, research-based, evidence-based. It is not just, why we're seeing all these infertility challenges. It is really our reality. So helping people understand that if you're abiding by the CECO, the calories in, calories out, you're missing out on other opportunities to consider why people are dealing with weight loss resistance or struggling to lose weight.
I want to hear from you, Cynthia, because you fast. So your last meal is at 5 o'clock. Me too. I love that earlier dinner. How has fasting changed your life?
I came to fasting like everyone else I know does. I was in my early 40s. I had a husband who did a lot of international travel. At the time, my boys were very young, which meant I was, carpooling to sports and doing, I was just exhausted. And I had a very stressful job working for a very large cardiology practice. And I was probably exercising too intensely for that stage of my life. And I probably was too low carb. And I can retrospectively look back and say there's probably a lot of things that just kept adding stress to my plate. Add in perimenopause, which is when many women will start saying, like, everything that I used to work doesn't work anymore. So I came to intermittent fasting under that guise, and I didn't initially lose weight. I actually came to fasting and realized, like, I feel so mentally clear. I can round on patients from 7 a.m. in the morning until 12 o'clock, and then I'm like, oh, I'm hungry. I'm going to eat then. So for me, it was very life-altering in terms of reduction in bloating. I felt much more mentally clear. And then over time, the weight loss came as I understood what was actually going on in my body in early perimenopause. But I think for a lot of individuals, they come to it out of a curiosity, but they stay for all the other benefits. And certainly that's been my trajectory. And I think it's important to say that fasting has a season and a reason. So there have been times over the last, 10 years when I have not fasted, and we can talk about that. But I think for a lot of individuals, I think what's so important about fasting is it's flexible. So you don't have to be rigid. There's a lot of people who like rigidity in their lives. I don't encourage anyone to be super rigid about fasting. Like, as an example, today I went to the gym. It was the second day this week. I lifted weights for my legs. When I came home, I was like ready to eat. So I actually had something very small. I'll eat a bigger meal after we're done having our conversation. But I think it's super helpful for people to understand that depending on, where you are in your menstrual cycle, depending on, how heavy you lifted in the gym, I don't believe in stressing my body more than it needs to be stressed. And I think we have people that like to white knuckle fasting, like they're miserable while doing it, and they'll push themselves anyway. And so that's not the way to fast. I think fasting is designed to be able to be integrated into your lifestyle. there's a time to fast. There's a time not to fast. My husband fasts and really enjoys it. My teenagers do not fast. I get asked that question all the time. They're still growing. I mean, they're 18 and 16, but they're, you know, very athletic, lean boys. I would never encourage them to fast. They're still developing. They're not done developing. And so I think on a lot of different levels, the desire to fast comes out of a curiosity to lose weight. And then people end up staying for all the other benefits because they're like, now I recognize what true intrinsic hunger feels like. I have less bloating. My bowel movements are more regular. I'm sleeping better. How many middle-aged women don't sleep well? And then they start fasting and all of a sudden their sleep improves. And so I think that it really comes down to what are your goals? Where are you life stage? Because a woman that's under 35 is different than a woman that's in perimenopause versus menopause. And men have it so much easier because they don't have as much hormonal fluctuation. But I think it's looking at where are you life stage wise? You know, are you male or female? I think all those things matter. And then obviously, what are your goals? Like, I will say that I meet a lot of very young women. Like, let's say they're 30, they're lean, they exercise a lot. They have no business fasting every single day. I think fasting in a certain part of their cycle, maybe every couple of days, once or twice a week, there's lots of benefits, but I don't like to see young, lean, athletic women doing a lot of fasting because, you know, our bodies are just exquisitely designed to nutrients and how we nourish our bodies. And if you're, even if you're choosing not to have children at that point in your life, your body's paying attention to how you're nourishing your body or not. And so that over-restriction, over-fasting piece, I see a lot of young women doing. And that's always a cause for concern because many people may not even be thinking about their fertility until they're, you know, in a relationship with someone special or they're ready to start having children and they don't even realize that they've been chronically undernourishing their body, which has impacted their fertility quite significantly.
I'm mindful, depending on who's watching and their thoughts about fasting. Fasting is fantastic and it works so well for you. It works well for me in a, you know, easier window, not too hard. But I want to touch upon your story where fasting didn't work for you and could have been quite detrimental. Could you elaborate more on that?
Yeah. So in 2019, so 5 years ago, I spent 13 days in the hospital. I ruptured appendix and a whole slew of complications. In fact, it became a running joke with all the specialists that were seeing me. Of course, this would only happen to a healthcare provider because this wouldn't happen to the average person. But in 13 days, I lost 15 pounds. I went home with a drain. I had a fistula that developed between my cecum, which is part of the colon, and my appendix, which was still ruptured. I was too sick to take to surgery. I went home with a central line because I was getting IV antibiotics. And I was so incredibly weak. And I literally could not tolerate much of anything. My mom, my Italian mom was home. So she made bone broth and stewed meats. And that's all I tolerated for 9 months. I'm not kidding. And so for me, I realized pretty quickly after being discharged that I was in no position to not be eating regularly because my body was so deconditioned. And so I was sharing with you before we started recording that I went to the hospital one day to see if they could pull this drain out. And just walking from the car, which was my mom dropped me off at the entrance of where I was, to the radiology suite, which was not very far, I was so deconditioned. I could tell my blood sugar was very low. I felt terrible. And so I did not intermittent fast for probably 4 to 5 months after that hospitalization because I was in no position to put my body under that amount of stress. Because we have to understand that intermittent fasting is a form of hormetic stress, beneficial stress in the right amount at the right time. And so for me, it was really understanding that there's a season and a reason for fasting. And that was the season of me taking a break. And quite honestly, it was really interesting to see, like, how do I do having, at that time, I had to do 4 to 5 small meals a day because my stomach, I mean, my entire digestive system had really taken a huge hit. And so for me, it was smaller meals more frequently. It kept my blood sugar stable. And then I was able to get to a point a couple months later where I was able to space out meals and I did much better. But I think it's important for me to disclose this because there's a time and a place to fast. And it was not the time and not the place for me to engage in fasting. And I would be irresponsible if I had forced myself to do that. That's, again, I go back to, do not white knuckle fasting. If it's not working for you, it might be there's a certain time in your life, or maybe it's where you are in your cycle, or there's too much stress. And so for me, my body was under a tremendous amount of stress, having not died in the hospital because I came quite close. And I don't say that lightly. I think I'm in a good place mentally now, but I realized how sick I was. And so for me, part of my recovery was learning to eat more frequently, smaller meals, and just allow my body to heal intrinsically.
I think it's so important to know what's working for you at that time and be open-minded, not to just have one fasting schedule, doing the same thing over and over and over and just stressing your body out. That goes very nicely into how to start fasting for people that are just wondering, well, Cynthia, how do I start? I want to get to your results, or I want to do an OMAD. We shouldn't be just doing an OMAD, but let's just, for the absolute beginner, that's just like, well, where do I start? What is the most gentle starting point to start fasting?
Yeah, I would say the first thing is to stop snacking, because snacking in between meals is a sign that you're not putting your meals together properly. So we're going to look at a macro level. Snacking is not necessary. No one should be snacking. I mean, if you're a five-year-old kid and you don't know enough to sit down and eat enough at a meal and you get hungry 2 hours later, that's very different. But as an adult, no one should be snacking. So we remove the band-aid of snacking. It forces you to structure your meals with enough protein. If you tolerate vegetables, great. And whatever the carbohydrate comes from, it could be that you have non-starchy vegetables if you tolerate those. You know, the next thing to think about is not eating after dinner. So you have, maybe you're having three meals, you've taken out the snacks, you don't eat from after dinner until breakfast the following morning. And I want everyone to think about breaking your fast as breakfast. So I break my fast at 10 o'clock in the morning. It doesn't have to be breakfast food. It could be leftovers from the night before. That's actually how I like to do it. And so really opening up that episode of digestive rest, if you will. I think 12 hours of digestive rest is exactly that. It still has benefits. Slowly opening up that window. For some people, they can do it pretty readily and quickly. They can go from 12 hours to 14 to 16 hours pretty easily. I think a lot of it depends on how metabolically healthy you are. So if you have been a sedentary couch potato eating an ultra-processed food diet, it's going to take you longer. It's going to take you longer, especially if you're insulin resistant or you're even diabetic. And if you're diabetic or if you have chronic health issues, make sure you talk to your healthcare provider before you start doing that, because you may need alterations in your medications. So we're going from, you know, 12 hours of digestive rest to 12 and a half to 13, and slowly people will make their way. It's important to understand it's important to hydrate your body. It's important to utilize electrolytes, especially if you are going lower carbohydrate or low carb or even ketogenic. You will get renal losses of electrolytes, especially sodium, and a lot of the side effects that people will experience, headaches, nausea, achy, are a byproduct of this loss of electrolytes. So stored glycogen, as your body is emptying up the stored glycogen, you're losing not just sodium, you can use potassium, magnesium, chloride. This can precipitate some of these symptoms that I was talking about. And so that's how people start. And it's water and electrolytes and then bitter coffee, bitter tea. Everyone freaks out. They're like, I love all the cream and the sugar in my coffee. Well, you know, it's interesting. I just interviewed Dr. William Lee. He was talking about if you put cream in your tea, as an example, your body will like kind of wall off the polyphenol. So a lot of these plant-based compounds that you get benefits from, bitter is inflammation for our bodies. We know bitter teas like green tea, black tea actually can boost fat oxidation. So for those of you that are like, yes, on the fat loss piece, bitter coffee, you can add things like high quality salt like Redmond's, or you can add cinnamon. That will not break a clean fast, but it can change and alter the flavor profile. I personally can't stand the taste of coffee. I never have. So I drink tea. And the way that I learned how to drink green tea was I brew it, I ice it, and I put a straw in it. That's how I work. I generally like bitter plant-based compounds, but I don't love tea, but I like tea. I enjoy tea because there are health benefits. So that's typically how we kind of work our ways through. And the next question is usually, what do I break my fast with? Protein. Always the answer is protein. You want to stabilize your blood sugar. You don't want to sit down and eat a plate of potato chips or ice cream or have a piece of pie or one of those protein bars I mentioned that tastes more like a candy bar. I get it. They're yummy, but that's not going to set you up. And if you look at the research on the first meal of the day, the most important thing you want to do is stabilize that blood sugar, because if you do that, you are less likely to eat for hedonistic reasons. You're more likely to eat because you're truly intrinsically hungry. So I usually will say, have some steak, have some chicken, have a piece of fish. If you like salad or you like vegetables, have those with it. You want either protein and a healthy fat. And if you have a ribeye, that satisfies both. Or if you have like duck, or you want some salmon, or you have protein and some carbohydrate. Now, again, I'm the first person to say, like, I like carbs, but I like my carbs from vegetables. That's generally where I like to get my carbohydrates from. And I'm of a certain age where I have to be more mindful of my carbohydrates. So if you're a woman in perimenopause or menopause, you may notice that your carbohydrate threshold is changing as your insulin sensitivity is changing. So those are some of my best tips. I think it's just as important what we break our fast with as it is important to understand we want a clean fast. We don't want to fudge it. Like, there's a lot of people that love to talk about, you know, like coffee bombs or fatty coffees or bulletproof coffee. And some of those drinks can be 400 to 500 calories. And if someone's weight loss resistant, is that really where I'd rather get it from real food? But if you are that standard American diet, couch potato, sedentary, really struggling to get to 14, 15 hours, then maybe adding a little butter or a little bit of MCT oil, which is generally my personal favorite, adding in some MCT oil will get you a little bit of expansion in that fasting window. But understanding we don't want to be in a position where we're getting 500, 400 calories from a coffee drink like that. You know, if you just don't want to eat, that's a whole separate conversation. But I think a lot of people assume if you're drinking your calories, they don't count. And this is something that I think people have to really investigate. Like, I love Dave Asprey. I've met him many times. I've been a guest on his podcast. But I always look at Dave and I'm like, I would rather just have the green tea and then later on, you know, get that caloric intake from something else I'd enjoy more. Like, half a stick of butter and half a cup of cream, like, that does not appeal to me. That would not do well in my digestive system. But I'm sure there are probably some of you that are like, hey, I really enjoy having a bulletproof coffee every once in a while. That's different. But if you're doing it every day and you're weight loss resistant, that's a really easy way to remain weight loss resistant.
So starting off the gentle way, which is a 12 hours of fasting, even 12 to 14 hours of fasting, would you call that time restricted feeding?
Yeah. I mean, I do think about it that way. And I think that time-restricted eating is just this prescribed time period in which you're not eating. And I know Sachin Panda has done a lot of research in this area. And so I think it's semantics when we're talking about this. You know, to me, whether it's time-restricted feeding or intermittent fasting, it's the same, in my mind, the same prevailing philosophy. And for everyone that's listening, you may do really well at 14 or 15 hours, and doing a longer fast does not appeal to you. You're not interested in it. And that is okay. And then I meet people that they want to go 18, 20, 22 hours every day. And I'm like, well, it's kind of hard to get all your food in one meal.
That's what we're going to talk about, some mistakes. So 12 to 14 hours is very good for fat loss. What about if you want the autophagy fasting? Can you also explain what autophagy fasting is?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So autophagy is this waste and recycling process in the body. You'll see some people talk about autophagy fasting. And what they're doing is they have a very protein restricted food intake, and they will increase their healthy fats with the thought process that in a low protein state, you'll have an upregulation in autophagy. This isn't something that I do with any regularity because I'm of a certain age where protein is king and I like to maintain and build muscle. So there's prevailing principles. There are the people, the longevity experts, and then people that are more in the carnivore muscle protein synthesis crowd. And that's kind of where I exist. And to be completely fair, most of the longevity experts look very sarcopenic and they're very skinny. And this is not a criticism, it's just observational. And then I look at my friends in the muscle protein synthesis, carnivore-ish crowd, and they look very different. And that looks healthy to me, whereas a lot of longevity experts just do not look particularly healthy. And I think at some point you have to decide for yourself, like, what is most important? And for me, I'm with the carnivore-ish group. So when we're talking about autophagy fasting, helping people understand that in this low protein state, we have this upregulation of autophagy. It's not something I do with any regularity. I do think autophagy is important. I think it's important, whether it's mitophagy, autophagy, helping people understand the role in the aging process, the role in most chronic disease states. You know, after the age of 40, most everything that you see is a byproduct of dysregulated autophagy or a reduction. It's one of the hallmarks of aging. Even it's something that is very, very helpful for people to understand. Like, we want to do the things that allow us to live our best lives and to have as much energy as possible, to sleep well, to exercise, et cetera. I think this is a strategy, one, you know, subset of intermittent fasting, but it's not something that I do ever. And I do talk about it in a program that I run, but it's not something that I do with any frequency. Again, because I go back to, I want to maintain and build muscle. And so a low protein state, I've been there 5 years ago, I was there, and I know what it's like when your body breaks down muscle to survive. And so muscle is this organ of longevity that I'm just not willing to negatively impact.
How does somebody choose their period of fasting? Because you've got the 12 hours, okay, or 14 hours, then you've got 16, 8, 18, 6, 20, and 4. And what I mean by 20 and 4, et cetera, is 20 hours of fasting, 4 hour feeding window. So how would, or even an OMAD, 23 and 1, how does somebody choose what they want to do and what's best for them?
Well, I think it depends on your goals. Most of the people I interact with want to build and maintain muscle. So that is going to have a different set of prevailing philosophies. So number one, no less than 100 grams of protein a day, no less than 30 grams of protein per meal. I eat 50 to 60 per meal. Just for me, I get about 110, 120 grams of protein in a day. And that's how I do it in two meals. So when you look at people that have wide feeding windows, it's probably fairly easy to get 30 grams per meal, at least 100 grams per day. As you start closing that feeding window, it gets harder and harder and harder. I don't know any women that can eat nutrient-dense foods of 100 grams of protein in one meal. I know plenty of men that can do that. And there's research to now demonstrate that, you know, we can eat upwards of 100 grams in a meal and our body knows what to do with it. So there are sometimes people that will say, oh, if we eat more than 30 grams, our body stores it as fat. No, that's actually not what happens, especially with protein. But I do think it's important for people to consider, are you north of 40, where we know sarcopenia or muscle loss with aging accelerates if you are not actively working against it? That's why strength training and adequate protein is so important. And why is the 30 grams of protein important? Because that's the amount that helps trigger muscle protein synthesis. And it hits a leucine threshold. And leucine is an amino acid. Very, very important to hit those thresholds to help stimulate muscle. You want to do you that. That's, I think that's the prevailing focus for most of the work that I do. So when someone says to me, I do OMAD and they're a woman, or they have a 20 hour fast with a 4 hour feeding window, the first thing I ask them is, how much protein are you eating every day? Because more often than not, they're chronically under eating protein. And by that, if I look at a diet recall of women like that, they're probably getting 40, 50 grams of protein. And I remind them that, and I'm a visual person, so I always use this as an example. Young muscle looks like a fillet. Old muscle, although delicious, looks like a ribeye. And the marbling that goes on in a ribeye is a byproduct of this, you know, inflammatory process. I know fat is delicious, and my husband and my younger son would say the ribeye is better. My older son and I would say the fillet is better. We just like leaner meat. My husband and younger son like fattier meat. But what's going on in our muscles, this is where we lose insulin sensitivity first. Very important for people to understand this. So insulin resistance starts in our muscles. So if you have no other takeaway from this conversation, it's track your macros, figure out how much protein you're eating every day to help offset what's happening as we're getting older. So sarcopenia will happen if you don't work against it. That's why the strength training and adequate protein is so important, and stress management and sleep and all that. But for a lot of individuals, when they start tracking their macros, they realize, oh, I can't get enough protein in one meal. I can't get it in two meals. And that's okay. You know, I have some women that do two good sized meals, and then they have a whey protein shake. And if you tolerate dairy, I think that's totally fine. Just find the cleanest option that works for you. But I think in a lot of different levels, there's this lack of awareness. We've been conditioned to believe that meat is detrimental. Red meat is bad for you. Red meat raises cholesterol. High cholesterol is the basis for heart disease. That's completely been disproven. And I think for everyone listening, it's like, figure out what makes your body feel good. For me personally, I do really well with lean meat, lean protein, lean fish, lean poultry. That's what works well for me. I love eggs. I'll eat ground bison. I love all these things. And then I have other people that love fatty meat, and that works really well for their bodies. So figuring out what works well for you, but being cognizant of where's your protein intake. Because if you are chronically under eating protein, you're going to spin down the muscle that you have on your body. And, you know, bioimpedance scales, BOD pod, that's usually what I like to use. They have a much more accurate reflection than standing on a standard scale, which just tells you what you weigh. It doesn't tell you how much muscle mass to body fat that you have. But I think most of us have a good sense of where our body fat is to muscle ratio. A lot of people start getting less hungry in their 40s. That's certainly been something that I've seen as a middle-aged woman. So, you know, when my appetite goes back up, I usually know that I'm creating and fostering more muscle development. So just as an aside, your fasting and feeding schedule should correspond with how much protein you need. So if you are ideally 150 pounds of a woman or a male, that's what you want to be working towards. It may not happen overnight, but over time, that's what you want to work towards.
So when it comes to choosing your fasting window, I like to give a general advice to people. What would be the ideal fasting protocol for somebody that just wants to start? I've heard 16-8 is very popular.
I think a 16-8 is a reasonable option because it still gives you 8 hours to eat. It's not too long of a fast. And I think for a lot of people, they can work their way up to it and they kind of feel like, okay, I can do the 16 hours. I feel really good. If I decide to do a 17, I'll see how I feel. Maybe that's too long. But what I like about a 16 is that it gives someone, you know, 4 hours in between meals, and that's really important. So that's a good starting point. Obviously, there's different types of fasts or different types of goals. If someone, as an example, is insulin resistant, has a lot of weight to lose, maybe they're diabetic, they have lots of stored fuel, right? They have lots of stored fuel. So they could go 2 to 3 days without consuming food. And for a lot of people, that helps them get out of plateaus. It helps them kind of do a jump start. I've had a lot of obese patients tell me that a 2 to 3 day fast, which obviously they would do in conjunction with their healthcare professional, especially if they're on medications, it helps them like reset their palate. They're like, okay, I've been craving junk food. I would say after Christmas, after the holidays, a lot of people are craving junk and crap. And they'll do a 2 to 3 day fast the first couple of days of the year. And they're like, okay, now I'm ready to get back on track. So there is a purpose for longer fast, but it really depends on your goals. Like another example is, you know, doing a 3 to 5 day fast where, you know, you can impact telomere length and stem cell activation and all these other benefits. But I can honestly tell you that since my hospitalization 5 years ago, I don't do long fasts anymore. I did a 13-day fast. I have no desire to ever do another 13-day fast or a long fast. I think a lot of it depends on your goals. And for me, it's reflecting back on that muscle preservation, muscle mass, building muscle mass, maintaining it. And when you start getting over 24 hours, even if you're a lean person, it's really this cost benefit. Like I actually will talk to Dr. Ted Naiman again next week. And this is something he talks about. We're about the same age. And we're both very lean. And I'm like, I don't want to lose what muscle mass I have. And so for me, anything more than 24 hours just doesn't make sense. But for someone who is a different stage of life or is insulin resistant or has a lot of weight to lose, that might be a good way to kind of jumpstart or break through some plateaus.
So I want to get into something very interesting, which is things that affect your fast. Because people have this question. My first one is stevia and artificial sweeteners. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think this depends. So I'll go back and say the same thing. If you are weight loss resistant or obese, or you're dealing with a lot of sugar cravings, I think whether it's stevia, monk fruit, sucralose, aspartame, and I'll explain in a second why I don't put those all in the same boat. But if you have a sugar handling problem, artificial or cleaner sugar options are not necessarily beneficial. Now, people will argue till the cows come home, stevia doesn't impact my blood glucose. Well, I bet you it impacts your insulin because it's sweet on the tongue. There's something called the cephalic phase insulin response. If I put something sweet on my tongue, you better believe my body thinks food is coming. And so I always say that if you are thin and you're at your goal weight, I don't think having a stevia sweetened beverage is going to make a difference. But since we know so many of us are not metabolically healthy, that can make a difference. Now, if you look at the research on, and there was a research study that was done, I think in September of 2022 in Nature, talking about sucralose, aspartame, stevia, and I think saccharin, and it made me laugh. I was like, who still uses saccharin? I think about that from my grandmother used to drink Tab like 1,000 years ago. And so it was looking at the impact of those on oral glucose tolerance, which is important. And then they looked at the impact on the gut microbiome. And so not surprisingly, sucralose aspartame had the greatest net impact, and then stevia a little less. But I think it's important for us to understand like these artificial sugars, and by that I mean saccharin, sucralose, aspartame, are very different to me than like stevia, monk fruit, thyrotol. I mean, if you have a sugar handling problem, you have a sugar handling problem, you should probably avoid all of those. But with that being said, I think when you look at the research, and some of this was done, I believe, on mice, so they're a mouse model, it's not a human, but understanding that in 1 month's time, or I think it was 28 days, the sucralose, the aspartame, the saccharin, the stevia all had a negative impact on oral glucose tolerance. They also had a negative impact on the gut microbiome, and we've talked about the gut microbiome and how important it is, and that's in the colon, the large intestine. And so I go back to, most of us are so conditioned for sweetness, we're always looking for another fix. We're just a bunch of sugar junkies. And so I always reflect on, what is your relationship with sugar, number one? Number two, are you just looking for a solution to a problem? You know, are you using stevia because you really do have a sugar problem? You're a sugar addict, or you're someone that is always looking for something that's sweet. I tend to be a salt person. Like, I'm like, anything I can put, anything that's a conduit to salt, I'm like, ooh, that's why I love electrolytes in my drinks. And I like salt probably way more than the average person. But when we look at stevia as an example, there is, you know, people have glucometers and CGMs and they'll say, well, I didn't see anything change. People love to argue with me on social media all the time. And my team and I kind of laugh at this. I'm like, yes, but there's something called the cephalic phase insulin response. And that's what I think you need to think about. If you think that you have a disordered relationship with sugar, you probably need to limit it or eliminate it. And I always say, if you can't moderate, you eliminate. I don't think I have a problem per se with stevia. So if I have stevia sweetened chocolate, like Lily's brand as an example, I can moderate it. But there are other things I don't moderate as well. And so I just don't have them. But I think it's important for people to just be honest with themselves and say, you know, maybe I have an unhealthy relationship with sugar and maybe I need to work on that. And, you know, there's a program that we run a couple times a year that is essentially like a sugar-free diet for 28 days. Oh my gosh, the sugar detoxing that goes on is unbelievable. And I always say to people, like, use this as a litmus test for the fact that for so many of us, we think of sugar being benign and innocuous, but it's in everything. It's in condiments, it's in ketchup, it's in mustard. I think one of my kids was saying the other day, they're now adding sugar to salt so that people want more of it. And it's a disturbing trend. So, you know, eat less processed, be conscientious and honest with yourself. And if you have to add stevia to everything in an effort to consume something, that might be a sign. Like if you have to sweeten up your tea and your coffee all the time, that's a sign that, you know, you may be a sugar addict and you're just not realizing it.
The word sugar addict is very controversial. So it's not saying that stevia is bad, have it if you need to, but it's just to open the mind up to say, okay, is it affecting your body? Is it causing the cephalic insulin response? Just be mindful of that. The next thing is, you mentioned bulletproof coffee. Obviously, if you had 400 calories in the morning, that's going to affect your fasting results. But what if you add a tablespoon of heavy cream or a tablespoon of butter, you know, 100 calories, 50 calories, does that affect your fast?
You know, this is when we start to split hairs. So I would say, you know, based on my research, a tablespoon of MCT oil is going to be processed differently than having butter or cream. Those are insulinemic, so they will evoke an insulin response. But again, I go back to, are you thin? Are you at a healthy weight? It's not going to make a big deal. But, you know, if we're really going to split hairs, like I occasionally use lemon in my water, but I am during my fast, but I am a healthy weight. I'm insulin sensitive. It's not going to make a difference. But if I were obese and not at a healthy weight and really struggling with weight loss resistance, those kinds of habits can make a difference. And so I invite everyone just to have an honest conversation with themselves to say, does this habit serve me well? Without judgment. Like to me, I'm like, when people ask, does it break a fast? And I say, yes, this does, or no, this doesn't. I'm like, listen, there's no judgment. If you still decide to do that, do understanding what, you know, the potential exists that if you're struggling to lose weight, that could that be, like, as an example, I have a lot of women who they love Element. And so they want to use Element 24/7. And I'm like, that's great. You're getting your electrolytes, but do you have a sugar handling problem? Are you a sugar addict? Is this what's hindering, you know, because still you can make the argument if you're drinking this copiously throughout the day, could this be, you know, in between your eating, could this be creating a problem for yourself? And so just inviting people to consider that some of our habits may not serve us well. Now, again, I go back to, are you insulin sensitive? Are you metabolically healthy? Are you at your goal weight? Do you feel like you're at a healthy weight? You probably have a little bit of leeway around some of those things without stressing about it. And if you were to say to me, like, my greatest joy in life is having a coffee with a tablespoon of heavy cream, I would say enjoy it and, like, don't stress about it. Like, I think we stress about these things so much. Like, the questions that I get in some of my groups, I'm like, holy cow, like, there's a lot of stress going on with this. So, like, let's think big, like, let's think at a macro level, like, how is this impacting our health? And then decide, like, is this worth getting upset about? Or is this something like, maybe this is contributing to some of the problems I'm seeing? Like, maybe I should cut it out and see what happens.
What about alcohol in your feeding window? Is that going to affect your fasting window results?
It could. I mean, so if we understand that there's now a lot of emerging research coming out that alcohol really doesn't have any health benefits, our body prioritizes it as a toxin. If we are eating while we're drinking a glass of alcohol, whether it's a martini or we're having a glass of wine, I always think about big picture. Certainly people in middle age who already are dealing with some sleep disruptions, who may be less insulin sensitive, that glass of wine could turn into a poor night's sleep, which we know impacts leptin, ghrelin, glucose, insulin, and food choices made the next day. It's always in the context of, does it serve me? I have never had a problem with alcohol, for full disclosure. I'll just use myself as the example. In my 20s and 30s, I learned to drink dirty martinis. I would have one. I would sip on it maybe once a week, always socially. And during the pandemic, I just stopped drinking. And I thought to myself, oh my gosh, my sleep is so much better. One drink a week. And so understanding that we are in a culture where alcohol is not looked upon the same way that other types of drugs are. And so there's very much a mommy drinking culture. I'm going to just state this for the obvious. And so I think a lot of people just don't even realize that their relationship with alcohol may be impacting their goals that they have for themselves. Maybe it's impacting your sleep. Maybe you are weight loss resistant. Maybe it's causing you to eat foods you wouldn't otherwise eat because it's dysregulated your blood sugar. Or, you know, maybe this is the reason why you're, you know, chronically inflamed. Or, you know, worse than that, it's understanding the net impact on a lot of other things in our lives. So this is not stated pejoratively, but we've been conditioned to believe that alcohol has a lot of health benefits. And I think the emerging research is suggesting otherwise. So if you're going to drink, I would look at biodynamic or organic wines. I would stick with clear liquors, you know, like gin, vodka, tequila. Although for those of us that have maybe over the course of your lifetime have had a bad night with tequila, I'm like, I can't even smell it. It's still gives that Pavlov's dog, but understand there are better choices. So always like good, better, best. And I think that you can exist as an adult and not drink if that's your choice. But just understanding how it can set things up. And for me, my sleep is too precious to drink alcohol. So I gave it up 4 years ago and I haven't looked back, but there's been a lot of pressure just socially when I go out. It makes other people uncomfortable and I don't make it an issue. I'm like, I show up with my kombucha or my sparkling water and a lime, no one knows the difference, but it makes people very uncomfortable.
The last thing I want to ask you is mistakes, because you probably have seen a lot of things that could affect people's fasting. What would be the top three mistakes that you would say people make when they start fasting or do fasting?
Yeah, I would say number one, forcing a fast. So this is in the context of there's a time in a woman's menstrual cycle, and I talk a lot about this in the book, of when we can get away with fasting versus times when we should reduce the amount of fasting that we're doing or really just do a 12-hour digestive rest. So that's number one, not observing where you are in your cycle, or contrary to that, perimenopause or menopause and women forcing a fast when they have like too much stress, they had terrible sleep, They're going through a divorce. They lost their job. There's just a lot of stress. It's like adding gasoline to a fire. I would say number two, not understanding how to fuel their bodies. So it goes back to the macros. Not enough protein, too many carbs. The carbs are a huge issue. I don't see fat being an issue. I think my generation, your generation probably aren't fat phobic. Like my mother's generation is still completely fat phobic. Like trying to encourage my mom to have more than like a quarter of an avocado is still an issue. But I do think the macros piece, like what you break your fast with matters, how you fuel your body and your feeding window matters. And then I would say lastly, I think it's this prevailing philosophy. I call it the triad of overfasting, over-restriction, over-exercising. Like women get into this trap. And I do see it with men, but not as significantly. Women are just hard on themselves. Women become weight loss resistant for a multiplicity of reasons. And then they find that they're like, if a little bit of fasting works, then more is better. If a little bit of what you can insert, carbohydrate restriction, fat restriction, whatever it is, they do more restriction. So they're undernourishing their bodies. They have a very, very tight feeding window. They're really undernourishing. And then they overexercise. And so those are the things that I get the most concerned about. And to be totally transparent, number three has become such a huge issue that I'm starting to speak out more about it because there's a lot of disordered relationships with food. It's not just unique to the fasting community, but there's a lot of that on social media, whether it's orthorexia, whether it's anorexia that people hide. They hide that in their intermittent fasting. They're really just not eating. And so for me, I just feel like as a woman, as a clinician, I have to just be transparent and say, this is why I've started speaking about this more often, because I see a lot of troubling patterns and a lot of troubling messaging that goes on. And that's why I think I owe it as a woman. I've been in this intermittent fasting community for such a long period of time that I more often than not have women stop fasting because they're doing too much, or I have them stop fasting because they don't have a healthy relationship with their bodies and with food. And so we have to kind of work on that first. So those are the three most common things that I see. I'm curious to know if that's what you expected me to say, or were you thinking I was going to say something else?
That was what I was expecting, the overdoing it. I actually wrote down was vegan diets, doing fasting with a vegan diet, that because of the protein emphasis, and protein is so important, and fasting is very important for the right reason. And it's the extremes. It's, you don't want to eat the whole day and you don't want to be snacking because you want to have that rest and digest process. If you're eating a vegan diet plus fasting, how on earth are you getting your nutrients? I'm not against veganism. Well, I'm the opposite of vegan, but I don't get vegan with fasting.
Well, so number one, my mom was a vegan for over 10 years, and like watching my mom, her health spiral, and then trying to help her get back to a healthy eating pattern and have more animal based, more of an omnivore, which she loves vegetables. So like that's her happy place. But to echo your sentiments, you know, when a woman who's choosing to be vegetarian or vegan, and I respect that, comes through our programs and we're trying to talk to them about higher protein, and they're trying to get it from, first of all, we always ask like, do you do dairy and eggs? If they do, I'm like, okay, we can work with this. But if they don't, it is really challenging because most of the vegetarian protein sources are either soy, which I'm not a huge fan of, or the amount of carbohydrate to protein is so disparaging. Like, you know, 6 cups of quinoa to 6 ounces of steak. It's like, I don't know many middle-aged women that can tolerate that carbohydrate load. Like they just can't. And so I typically will say 30 grams of carbs in a meal max, and, you know, 50 to 60 grams of protein. And so that really becomes problematic. And I would say this is not coming from a place of judgment. It's just, I'm trying to figure out how to support your nutritional philosophies, but also help educate you as to why maybe we need to bring some eggs into your diet. Maybe we need to bring some dairy into your diet so we can backfill. And I don't think a lot of vegetarians and vegans get into trouble until middle age. I think there's a lot of shaming about eating meat, which I think is unfortunate. Certainly not in my community, not in the realm of the health and wellness community that I'm in, because a lot of almost all of us are at least omnivores, if not carnivore-ish or carnivore. And I think that there's still a lot of shaming and ethical considerations that people will spout out about eating animals. Like if I want to throw a grenade on Twitter, I will talk about veganism. That is when I get so much hate. And we try very hard to navigate not being particularly inflammatory on social media. But if I want to anger a bunch of people, I will talk about veganism on Twitter. Even if I do it respectfully, I mean, the amount of trolls and nastiness that comes out, it's like swatting flies because they just get so triggered. And yet, I think it was, there's a woman in the United States who just came out. I just saw it on the news this morning, Wendy Williams. I'm not sure if you're familiar with her. She's a talk show host. She's 59 years old, and I think she's been vegan for more than 5 years. And she now has the same form of dementia that Bruce Willis does. And I'm not saying that there's a connection, but I am saying, you know, 59 years old and being having a diagnosis of, I think it's temporal dementia.
Frontal temporal dementia. My dad has it. My dad is, he's actually in an aged care facility 3 years after the diagnosis. So frontal temporal dementia, it's a debilitating disease. And that's why I'm so interested in nutrition and health because of that very reason. For dad, it was more alcohol, stress, not a healthy lifestyle. But that's why I'm not against veganism or vegetarianism. And as Dr. Ken Berry says, if you're vegan or vegetarian, you're mindful of your health. And maybe that is a good thing. But the nutrients that you need, it's just, and as you said, you only see this 20 years later.
Yeah. Well, and it's concerning. I mean, so we have a whole generation of women that, you know, my mom's generation post Women's Health Initiative. So that was a study that was released in 2002 when I was a new nurse practitioner at that time. All these women were taken off their hormone replacement therapy. So what do we see now? We're seeing a lot of neurocognitive effects, bone health effects, heart disease, et cetera. My generation certainly knows better. Like we're flipping the narrative and talking about HRT and how beneficial it is to our brain health, cognitive health. But I think it's incredibly sad when we start to realize like whether it's toxins we're exposed to, like alcohol. I have a parent, my father is an alcoholic, and seeing what's happening to him and his health is really concerning. I think for all of us, it's building awareness without judgment and helping to educate people without judgment. I always say, listen, I'm always open-minded. And it's someone, if you convince me of a different way of thinking, I'm always open to it. I'm not rigid. But I think for so many of us, it's like building that awareness of what works for our bodies, what makes us feel good, what allows us to sleep well, engage with our loved ones, because that's really what it's all about. It's like, you know, my husband and I are both in our 50s now. We're getting ready to be empty nesters in a couple years, which is hard to believe. And so, you know, from my perspective, it's like we were talking about this morning. I was like, I don't ever want to not be able to get out and walk our dogs in the morning and exercise and do all these things that we don't think about now. But I don't want to be 10, 15, 20 years down the road and not be able to be an active contributing member of society. That's what we want to avoid.
Absolutely. And that's why we love you and all the information that you provide. And that's why fasting and health and diet is so important. If people love you and want to hear more from you, where can they find you?
Thank you. So probably easiest to go to my website, www.cynthiathurlow.com. I have an amazing podcast called Everyday Wellness, which is truly one of my greatest joys in my business.
I hope you enjoyed this interview. Now you need to watch this video next with Professor Thomas Seyfried, all about how to stop cancer with diet and water fasting. I'll see you guys next week.